You are listening to the Mental Health Download from the nonprofit Mental Health Association Oklahoma. I'm Addie McCasland. This week's episode is sponsored by the Maxine and Jack Zero Family Foundation, a philanthropic entity dedicated to supporting Tulsans experiencing mental illness, medical challenges, or homelessness, as well as assisting transformational civic projects that better engage individuals with limited access to inspirational arts and cultural resources. Today, I am speaking with Susan Maxamen, founder and executive director of the International Arts and Mind Lab, Center for Applied Neuroaesthetics, a pioneering initiative from the Peterson Brain Science Institute at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She is also an assistant professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins and serves as the co-director of the NeuroArts Blueprint Initiative in partnership with the Aspen Institute. Susan is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Your Brain on Art, How the Arts Transform Us. It is a journey through the science of neuroaesthetics that offers proof of how our brains and bodies are transformed when we participate in the arts and aesthetic experiences. Additionally, she is a keynote at the 2023 Zero Mental Health Symposium themed New Horizons in Brain Science. We are so grateful to have Susan Maxamen on today as we dive into the fascinating relationship between brain health and the arts, as well as what led her down this path. The Mental Health Download starts now.
So my name is Susan Maxamen, and I am the director of the International Arts and Mind Lab Center for Applied Neuroaesthetics at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And I'm also the co-director of the NeuroArts Blueprint, which is an initiative with the Aspen Institute.
How long have you been there?
So I'm the founder of the Arts and Mind Lab, and we began that project in around 2003. And interestingly, I had been working with the School of Education on arts and learning, and we had a donor come to Hopkins who wanted to give a large amount of money at the School of Medicine. But one of the criteria were that we needed to be able to study the arts, how the arts change our brains and bodies, because she believed that the arts really could save us. And so I was invited to come and really envision, dream about what that might look like. And that's how our lab started. So we've really evolved over the years, and the field has evolved over the years as well.
What are your degrees in?
So I'm a translational researcher, and my background is highly interdisciplinary. I have a master in advanced studies, where I'm really looking at implementation science. And then my undergraduate work is in journalism and communications. And my earlier work was in creative arts therapy and recreation therapy.
Oh, so worlds collide, right? All three of your worlds come together.
Yeah. And I'm such a big fan of interdisciplinary work because I'm a product of that. And I really think that to solve the problems of today and tomorrow, we really need an interdisciplinary lens.
Sure. You say I'm a product of that interdisciplinary work. Can you say more about that?
Sure. So a lot of times we think about people that work in academia or in science as having a fairly straight path. But my path has been very traversing, meaning that I've done a lot of work with different age groups and different sectors, and also looking at a lot of different kinds of issues, whether that's in child development or mental health, looking at things around aging, healthy aging, creative aging, also thinking deeply about the role of communities, how different sectors come together. So I think one of my strengths has been that I have an incredibly curious nature and have always been interested in how things work. And that's been a real driver for me. And so it's moved me into lots of different disciplines and fields and what I think of as ways of knowing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So when you were presented with this opportunity to pursue the research with art and your brain, did you have any expectations that were met, or did you have any findings that were surprises to you?
So that's a great question. So let me step back for a second. Sure. We talked a little bit about my background academically and some of the areas that I've moved in and out of. But along the path, my first job was in public television, where I developed educational programming using experiential learning for adults and then for children. And then I ultimately moved into working with museums and libraries and cultural arts organizations to think about how the arts could inform different communities for different needs. And then ultimately worked for a company that developed strategic plans to make those organizations sustainable. So, you know, interesting background. Then I started two companies. One was an arts and learning company called Curiosity Kits, which was looking at arts for health, well-being, and learning around thinking about the role of culture, science, and then art, but really, again, a very experiential kind of company that we worked with schools and community arts organizations. And then I started another company that was a digital learning company for early learning. So creating characters. So my background in coming to the FIRSTA School of Education at Hopkins was really always about how arts and aesthetic experiences changed us physiologically and psychologically, and how these experiential, highly salient experiences were the way we learn and grow best. So I was coming into the School of Medicine with that knowledge. And the canvas was blank. It was really, how do you think about how you might study this in context of medicine and healthcare, but also how it might really help us in terms of prevention and well-being. And so I didn't really know a lot about medical schools because I hadn't worked in one before. I knew a lot about educational systems and business, but I came to it with a mindset of an entrepreneur. And really, how do I build something? And that actually has served me really well because I really came in to understand systems, complex systems, but then to think about how to solve problems within those complex systems and to create milestones and deliverables and tangibles. So every year in my lab, we create a progress report. We have a strategic plan. We have 3 to 5 year strategic plan. And that was really new to the School of Medicine. That's not really how medicine worked when I first started. And so it took a while to build credibility. You know, what is this unicorn doing in this environment? But well received, open arms, really ability to, from a medical school to embrace innovation and creativity. And to think about what would be helpful in these different medical disciplines, including things like neurology, psychology, public health, psychiatry, cancer, all the different disciplines that are within a healthcare system. So we began there, and then we started to look at how do you study this? How do you create a generative model? And in that work, we developed something called the impact thinking model with lots of different practitioners and clinicians, to be able to really study the arts for different outcome measures. And then started to really start to think more deeply about how can you bridge clinic to community? And so that work has also been highly robust in our lab, but also in many other labs, thinking about, you know, if you're really thinking about downstream problems, you have to start upstream. So you have to start in early childhood, you have to start in community health, so that hopefully you minimize the amount of people that need these very intense healthcare systems to be inpatient. And you also look at prevention and intervention. And it turns out that the arts and aesthetic experiences are highly protective and highly preventative. So I had to really learn my way around to really figure out how I danced with these very extraordinary clinicians and researchers, all in service of trying to help people get better faster and sustainably.
Mm-hmm. So a kind of a practical question here. You mentioned that you work in, say, 3 to 5 year plans. You develop 3 to 5 year plans to facilitate your work, to organize the research that you're doing. Is that correct?
Lab or the center. So we work in 4 buckets. One is research. The second is outreach and education. The third is leadership development. And then the fourth is really thinking about practice and what practice really looks like. And so in each of those 4 areas, we really look at what is our research trajectory? What are we trying to achieve in there? What do we want to do in terms of outreach and education, leadership development, community building? And actually on Monday, we have our annual offsite with our entire team where we evaluate where we've been and what we've been good at and what we need to double down on or solve for in different ways. And where is that work taking us over the next, you know, is the next year the right set of variables, or do we need to modify where we're going based on external conditions or learnings that we found? So we're a highly iterative group.
Sure. Okay. So I think you probably just answered my next question. I was, you know, you mentioned the 3 to 5 years, and I was thinking that is a short time. It's a long time. 3 to 5 years is a long time, but it's also a short time, especially with the as quickly as things evolve now, and as innovative as sciences and as innovative as the arts have become. So I was wondering what it's like to plan that far out, knowing that some things may be obsolete. Sometimes you may have to pivot. How do you account for that? Or how do you navigate the rapid pace with which the world changes?
So I think about the way that you iterate and think about strategy in this way. I think that there is strategy and there's opportunity. And strategy is something you can control. Opportunity is something that you need to take advantage of, that you need to respond to. So we always have a strategy, but we're agile and flexible to be able to see an opportunity and advance that opportunity if we need to. So we can pivot in order to do that. And communication is really key. Our team in their lab, we have about 12 people in and out of the lab, from, you know, directors of research and communications people to research folks and research assistants. And then we also work with, you know, dozens of people across the university and across the country and around the world. So these highly complex partnerships are really important, and being able to know what's happening, because this is a field that's highly collaborative. Mm-hmm. We're all sort of thinking about sort of what that North Star is. So in our lab, we have kind of carved out what we do best. And that's in terms of really thinking about the foundational ways that you create translational research for impact. And then how do you train people to do that? And how do you bring that into the world? So that's kind of our scope. For the NeuroArts Blueprint, we have a 5-year plan that started from a series of 5 recommendations. And those recommendations, one is to increase the rigor of research in the arts. The second is to expand and honor the practitioners' work in the field. The third is looking at funding and sustainability. The fourth is looking at communications across the entire multiple fields that are part of this work. And then the last is capacity building and leadership development. So those 5 recommendations were put into an implementation plan that's a year-by-year strategy. And to your point, even now, it's a global initiative. There are things that people have accelerated. We have something called the Community NeuroArts Coalitions. We weren't going to start those till next year, because we wanted to finish up some other work. But we had such a huge influx of interest, we decided to start that early. So that's an example of an opportunity where we move something forward. But in moving that forward, we had to really think about, well, what is that shift and how do we staff for it? How do we make sure we have the right resources for it? So the agility of that is really important. But I think we're all managing complexity and we're all managing these multiple spinning plates. And it so comes down to communications.
Sure. What does a day in the lab look like? I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, it's varied, but for those who are like me trying to visualize what this work actually looks like, can you describe it or a sample day of it?
Sure. So our lab since COVID has been more virtual than in person, and we're not a wet lab. We really are an applied lab. So our projects happen all over the country, sometimes all over the world. So we have a series of research meetings, education meetings, outreach gatherings, where we're really reviewing what a project, where we are, the status of a project. Yesterday was probably a good example. We are in the process of applying for several grants. So we had several meetings around what are the aims for those grants, and then what are we thinking about in terms of what other resources, other disciplines we might bring into the community? How do we think about the budgeting of that? Other days we are in the field conducting focus groups or implementing survey instruments or working with other researchers. One of the projects we're working on right now is on set and setting for psychedelic experiences. So we just finished getting approval, IRB approval, for a series of studies looking at music. So I like to think of my weeks as a life cycle where sort of different days have different criteria that lead up to accomplishing some of the milestones that I mentioned in terms of our strategy. So for myself, I try to think about Mondays and Fridays as days where I am potentially writing articles or reports or working through some of the kind of analytical, theoretical work. And then Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays are really operational, and whether we're doing research or we're coming together to brainstorm kind of what project or where a project is and where we need to go, working on curriculum or any of the other activities, preparing for some of the outreach work that we're doing. So I think there's a cadence to the way we come together, but the projects are dynamic. So we also like to hit pause every now and then and just evaluate where we are and where the roadblocks are. And that's what we do when we have offsites. And then we have team meetings where everybody comes together every other week just to kind of take the pulse of where people are. And then we come together physically as well.
So how long have you been researching the relationship between art and the effects that it has on your brain and your body and your behavior?
So really in our lab, we started doing this work in 2003. And prior to that, my work with arts and learning started around, the early 2000s. So quite a long time. I would say my career has really been over 40 years of really understanding the neurobiology or the cognitive science or the psychological benefits of the arts for different purposes, whether that's learning or mental well-being, mental health. So I've been at it a while.
Sure. I was wondering, obviously, you know, we all say this a lot. Before COVID, we did X, and since COVID, we do it this way now, it being whatever it is that, you know, professionals are doing. And you've already mentioned that that's no different with you. The COVID changed some of the nature of the way you all have to conduct your research. It also obviously changed the way that we all conduct our lives and interact with the world, including the arts, meaning so much is virtual now, so much is digital now. And I'm wondering how the virtual options of engaging with the arts is different from the more three-dimensional, more, I guess, primitive version of experiencing the arts. For example, you could walk into a museum and just experience the museum as it was, or during COVID, you could get online and take a virtual tour of a museum. And I'm wondering if that has different effects on the brain, the body, or the behavior.
So years ago, there was a book. And the last line of the book, it was not about this at all, but the last line of the book was, sometimes substitutes will do. And that's how I feel about virtual experiences. I think when it comes to the arts, and I'm talking about, you know, as a beholder, I think the live experiences are shown to be more impactful, but that doesn't mean that the virtual experiences aren't. I think they offer a different opportunity. You know, you go to a movie and the difference between IMAX and a movie theater versus a movie on your television, they're all a form of art and they all have an experience. And I think depending upon what the content is and where you are from a psychological and physiological experience, you're changed, you're impacted by that. But I think technology has been a really important connector for us. And, you know, I think technology does a lot of things. One is it's allowing us to understand the physiology. So the research, I think, as interventions, virtual reality, and is being used very effectively for things like ADHD through narrative or pain management, chronic pain through things like Snow World. And then from a dissemination and scaling point of view, the ability for technology to amplify anything that we're doing is enormous. But if you can have, you know, a highly sensorial experience where you're smelling something, tasting it, touching it, seeing it, you know, experiencing it, mm-hmm. those experiences are what I think we're biologically wired for. So right. I think that's an important thing. And I think we all need more of that in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I have your book and I was also on your website. And one of the pages, it gave a list of, I believe, 10 art forms that you could engage in or one can engage in and to have a positive impact on you and the various benefits that those particular art forms would. And I'm wondering if engaging in, say, pencil and paper drawing is different than, say, drawing on an iPad tablet, if you have a piece of software in your iPad that allows you to draw. Do you experience the same benefits, or are there subtle differences from the two different mediums?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Your Brain on Art, How the Arts Transform Us, the book that you're referencing, that was the first time that we have really been able to coalesce a huge body of research around how the arts affect different areas of our lives and how different art forms actually work in some similar ways, but also importantly in different ways for different purposes. And so I think the nuances and the differences, large differences between different types of arts for different purposes is really extremely interesting. And I don't think most people really know that, for example, autobiographical music for people with Alzheimer's can actually help them become present, or dancing for Parkinson's can actually increase cognitive skills, lower stress, help people sleep better, improve gait. Your example of drawing using a pencil versus an iPad, how there are absolutely different experiences that come out of that, and in large part because of the tactile nature of the experiences. But then there are also some similarities. We see that cortisol is lowered when people are doing those kinds of focused drawing activities, whether they're using paint or an iPad or a pencil. But we also know too that there are additional benefits that happen beyond those sort of shared experiences, depending upon how long you're doing an activity, and what purposes you're doing it, if you're coming back to it over and over again to like complete a larger piece, if your motivation is to go more from interest to mastery. You know, one of the mythologies around, and one of the limitations that I think have kept us all from making art, creating things, is that we were told very young that we had to be good at it, or we had to be proficient, or we had to make a career out of it if we are going to do it. And so a lot of us come to these experiences with a sense of incompleteness and inadequacy. And I think that's also something that's really important as we think about this work, is that we now know through research is that you don't have to be proficient in order to have tremendous benefit, in large part because of these sensorial systems that are engaging, synapses that are creating neural pathways that are working whether you're good at it or not. So I think those are some of the things that are worth kind of unpacking.
So with that, you mentioned the cortisol, and that's number one on the list on your website, that making art, I'll just read it actually, making art can significantly reduce stress hormone cortisol in 45 minutes. And I'm wondering if it needs to be something that you enjoy doing. So I enjoy writing personally. I do not necessarily enjoy things like, let me think of something that I would not enjoy. My mother used to paint ceramics. And, you know, and she was artistic in that way, or make scrapbooks. Like, she was very, very tactile in that way. And that's just, it's not a thing that I love to do, nor is a thing that I was ever skilled at. So I'm wondering if this cortisol reduction benefit if it needs to be an art form that you enjoy to experience that benefit.
So I love to sing and I'm not good at it. I love to sing and the chagrin of everyone around me. I say I'm a composer. What I do is I don't write music, but I take standards and I redesign them. I create sort of the way that they get sung that nobody can understand what song it is. And I get tremendous benefit. You know, my vagus nerve is engaged. My parasympathetic nervous system goes into action. I'm just like in awe. I'm coated with serotonin and dopamine and I'm super happy. Nobody around me else is. But if you don't like something and you don't enjoy it, mm-hmm. it would go to the issue that you probably aren't going to get the kind of benefits from it because you're not enjoying it. Right. And I think that's one of the things about art is that it's pleasurable. Now you may find that the way your mom collaged or the way your mom created scrapbooks is just not but you might end up finding out that collaging is something that you really enjoy and that you enjoy it for different reasons. Or you might find that because your mom did scrapbook and you scrapbook and it brings back memories of your mom, that becomes enjoyable to you. But if you really don't like doing something, I talked to a fella a while back who said, well, I don't like any art. And I said, well, have you ever tried them? And he said, no, I just know that I wouldn't be good at them. And I only do things that I'm good at. And I said, well, what about dancing? He goes, oh no, I would never do that. And I said, well, do me a favor, stand up in your chair. And I just want you to shake your body. And just you and me, right? It's just you and me. And we weren't even on video. It was just audio. And I said, oh, just stand right now and just shake your body, put your hands above your head and just like move. And he did. And he started to laugh and he was like, oh my God, that feels so good. And I said, you can do it in a closet. Right? You can do it, you know, in the privacy of your own home, but do it for you. So the idea I think is that try things that you may not think you're good at or that you may not like. It's like food, right? You know, when you're a kid and your mother said, well, try this, you know, because you don't know it if you don't try it. And so I think having that playful exploration, which is one of the aesthetic mindsets that Ivy and I talk about, is go into something without judgment. And if you don't like it, you don't like it, right? And it's probably not something that you should keep doing because it's not going to lower your cortisol. It's not going to give you reward. It's not going to give you pleasure. But I think you'll be surprised.
Sure. Do you all have any studies or do you have any insight as to whether creating art or experiencing art from a non-creative standpoint has a greater impact on one's brain health?
So making or beholding, right? That's the question. There are overlaps and there are also differences. So the overlaps are around perspective taking and empathy and greater insight and reflection. So we get those whether we are a maker in our own personal reflections or we're a beholder and we're understanding how an other might see something and how we can relate to those. As a beholder, oftentimes there is a shared sense of connection with other audience members if you're in a group setting and a sense of awe that becomes contagious. I think one of the most important things about being a maker that's different from being a beholder is nobody can tell you what to do. It is you have agency, you decide. And creative expression is something that we often don't do because we're afraid to share that. And I think what's really important as a maker is to be able to make without the expectation of sharing. You may ultimately decide to share, but that figuring out that what you feel and what's important to you happens through that process of making. And I don't even want to call it a creative process. I think by design it is, but it's really when you write something down or when you doodle and you have it's unconscious. You're not saying I'm going to doodle this. You're doodling or you're creating a piece of collage, or maybe you're doing some kind of expressive writing. It's only coming back in that reflection of what you created. Do you really understand yourself? And that is a really important thing. I mean, we don't we're such a transactional, busy world that we often don't have time for the transformation or even the transcendence of understanding how we feel. Because when we know how we feel, then we can start to think about cognitive actions and behaviors that might respond to those feelings. And so I think making is something that we need to do as a practice, like exercise or good nutrition or good sleep habits, because it helps us know ourselves. And on the beholding side, when you're in those moments where you are experiencing the other's artwork, you start to understand where you fit in the world and what other people are thinking, and that's both like you and different from you.
That's interesting. So I happen to write for a local magazine here in Oklahoma. And since I've been doing that for, about 2.5 years or so, my assignments are always artists. It just happened to be that way. And one of the questions that I like to ask is, you know, whenever you're experiencing artistic block, you know, like I would as a writer, I'm like, what is it that you do? How do you get past that? And invariably their answers have always been, I stop creating for other people. And I whatever their medium is, they sit with it and have no plan, no strategy. They just enjoy it. And, you know, the process of it, not focused at all on the outcome. And another question that I ask them is how they get inspiration for, you know, to produce their work. And it is through going and experiencing other people's art. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, both of those function as a nice reset button for them. So yeah. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I love that. And, you know, you think about artists that bring so much to the world, artists also have to renew and restore. And I don't think we think a lot about that because we see them as performers, but they have the same requirements.
Sure. So, you know, as a lover of the arts and as somebody who is fascinated with brain health, I personally appreciate learning about your work. And I'm curious to know what the end goal for the research is. What is the purpose in doing this?
So I think the more we understand how our brains and bodies change on arts and aesthetic experiences, the more we can apply that in service of humanity, whether that's learning, physical health, mental health. And I think it gives us another way of knowing how to really live our fullest, most whole selves. And I think we've left so much of that on the table. I think we've marginalized the arts. We've marginalized artists, nice to have, not a have to have. And I think this knowledge around the research behind the arts really gives us another kind of knowledge that can really help us be our fullest.
What a lovely answer. Yes. Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about the presentation that you'll be doing at our Zero Mental Health Symposium with the theme New Horizons in Brain Science, and a little bit about your book, Your Brain on Art, which I noticed was a New York Times bestseller pretty quickly after it came out. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you. No, I'm really excited about meeting with the folks in Oklahoma. You know, I think this work is really fresh and innovative and a whole other way of changing the lens to change our lives. And it's always been with us. The arts have always been part of us from the beginning of humanity. It's really how we communicate, how we collaborate, how we heal, how we flourish. And so my goal for the talk is to really share some of the neurobiology about that at a very basic level. And then to sort of pull that forward, you know, I really believe in translation. And so how do you bring some of that knowledge forward and share how this work is being used in community practice, in psychiatry, in psychology, public health, social work? And I'm really looking forward to having a really full conversation about that with the community.
Sure. Is there anything else you'd like for the listeners to know?
Oh, you mentioned the book, and I think the reason that the book became a New York Times bestseller in 6 days is because the world is hungry for this. I think we're looking for other ways to feel whole. Yeah. And it's so funny because people read the book and they say, this validates what I've always felt and what I believe is true and what I do and what I need, or it's given me permission to mm-hmm. do what I felt I should do, but it seemed frivolous or it seemed not important. And so what I'm hoping is that this work allows us to be and to really be our individual unique selves. And, you know, that's the other thing that I've learned in this research is that there's no brain that's like another. Our brains are as distinct as our thumbprints. And what we bring in from experiences, what we bring in terms of emotion and vibration creates who we are. And so how do we create these enriched environments that really allow us to grow and learn and thrive, not just cope and survive? And I feel like that's the end goal.
Sure. What a great experience for both the reader and for you and Ivy Ross, your co-author, to know that you're putting such value out there.
Well, Ivy's amazing. And we really feel like this is our life's work. And so we're just thrilled about it and really excited to continue to work with a huge community and growing community all over the world that's really doing this work.
That's fantastic.
It's really a pleasure.
Susan, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed this conversation with Susan Maxamon. To learn more about her research, purchase her book, Your Brain on Art, How the Arts Transformed Us, or experience one of the most fascinatingly interactive websites online today, please visit www.yourbrainonart.com. To register for the Dezero Mental Health Symposium, please visit www.dezerosymposium.org. Thank you for listening to the Mental Health Download.